Hey team, how you doing? Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. Brett Hamilton Williams. Did you guys know that? You know my middle name was Hamilton? You know who's on the show today? Arthur Campella. Arthur Campella is a teacher at Columbia University. He has a lot of ideas, a lot of theories. He's going to share them with you today. It's a little different. It's a little less conversational, I have to admit. But it's a lot of information. Some of it, I'm not smart enough to understand. Some of it, I am smart enough to understand. I'm sure that you guys out there are a little bit smarter than me. You know what would be smart? You know what would be smart is if you went to Bayshore, New York right now before, that's Bayshore, New York, before Savage Classical potentially moves away. I heard a rumor. I should be confirming it with Richard, but he might be moving down south or something or moving to a different house or whatever. So if you want to see the original store, now's the time to go in there and tell him that Big Diaper Brett sent you. That's S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. Savageclassical.com. Arthur Campella is on the show. I want you to go to audibletrial.com/insider. I want you to go to warbyparkertrial.com/insider. And I want you to go to my website and donate money to me. Just give me the money. Why do you always need things? You kids. What is this? Oh, there she is. All right, that's a different... All right, that's not... I got to turn this off. I'm going to quit messages. I'm going to go ahead and turn the old Wi-Fi off. And then I also have to turn off the thing here. Turn on the airplane mode. That way no one bothers me. And I'm not getting bothered. I have a friend who at one point I was going to go see Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 with. And did I dodge a bullet with that one? So she's just now getting back to me. Anyway, well, thank you very much. Listen, today's show is going to be, I don't know what it is. It's just, it's August and, you know, it's real easy to feel bummed right now. It's easy for me to feel bummed. I had a kind of a blow to the quartet. The quartet didn't get into Chamber Music America. I had to break the news to them. We're sort of, I'm hoping that this whole thing lasts. It's very, very, fragile right now. Everybody has a lot going on in that quartet. So I'm trying to keep it together the most I can, but it's like, it's hard because we've kind of done all the concerts we're going to do that are paying. And now if we did any other concerts, it would just have to come out of my pocket, and my pocket is shallow and filled with, trash right now. Cause I don't have a trash can. Literally, like, my pockets to my stuff are usually filled with trash. It's disgusting. But in August, I have a little bit of time on my hands. I have my stupid, you know, leg, foot issue. I've got this thing on my, ankle. My ankle's killing me. Could barely walk yesterday. But I'm okay. I'm okay because what I'm doing is I wrote a new solo. I have not written a solo for a long time. I didn't write this right out of the gate. I've kind of been toying around with it. Had some of it written down. But polished it off in the last 2 weeks. And it sounded good. It's a nice, sweet little solo. It's long. But how do we do that? How do we do that? How do we finish something? How do we create in a time when, you know, there's a time vacuum. There's nothing to do. How do you do that? What's do you have to go to Woodstock like Bob Dylan did? Do you need to get up and have coffee and immediately get ready to work? It's like, well, that doesn't always work either. You burn out that way. And if you work tired, you're not working to your full capacity. So what do you do? I don't know. I don't have the answer for you. But I know that right now, everybody is really struggling with that. You've had your summer. You've had your fun. You know, you've been to the beach. You've been out with your friends. What do you do now? Well, now it's time to get to work. You get a little 2 week window here before the kids come back to school and everything goes to shit again. Not shit, but great, good stuff. Nice distractions from actually being an artist. But right now, this is where the real work can come in. This is that time of year where usually I end up getting a lot of cool stuff done, or I take a massive vacation. But I don't have money for a vacation now. I also skipped my my reunion, my 20-year class reunion. Was in Stockton. I'm sorry to those who went, and I would have loved to go. Trust me. I'm not one of those that's like, I don't need to see anybody. If I want to see somebody, I'll call them up. No, there's a lot of people that I know that I would be, had been really excited to see. You know, that perspective usually comes with the people that, that stayed near home. I didn't. So I always see Stockton as this magical place where, you know, people always, people were, everybody was kissing and doing drugs. You know what I mean? Because that's when I left. Everybody was in a good mood. Everybody was like, I'm going to be a dancer. So, you know, that's how I always will remember my time there. And then I go home for Christmas and I get reminded of some things. But actually, my parents moved to Sacramento, so those times are over. But these things that are important, class reunions, this is a very important thing. So is a friend's wedding. Very important things. You know, I know I poo-poo weddings as cold steak and cheap wine. But they're beautiful things. Every time I go to one, I'm like, you know, I'm glad I went. I'm glad I went sometimes. Sometimes I'm not. But there are sacrifices to be made. And they are not just financial. They are, we have a different schedule than people, a lot of us. I personally don't. I personally kind of have like a Monday to Friday, 9 to 3, 9 to 5 sort of situation. And by the way, let me preface this with the fact that I do not have my shit together at all. That yesterday I watched David Cross's Netflix special as a break, and I got through the whole thing, meaning that I had, what, 3 half-hour breaks? That's pretty pathetic. Last week I spent 2 hours arguing / talking with my mother. I find ways to waste time. I started smoking again. because I thought it was so much fun to just, you know, I have a smoke and get back to work. I'm not a smoker. What am I doing? That's ridiculous. So I dropped the cigarettes last week. But I do get things done. And I do get things done because I understand that that stuff's going to happen. I don't let it bother me. I don't let it make me feel bad because that's human nature. And I am in my home. I am working in a very distracting area where there's always something to clean. There's always something to eat. And there's always something to drink. Or smoke or whatever, or a game to play or a phone conversation to have or something. There are lots of people that I have not talked to. I need to call my dad back. I need to call Miss Brett back, who I taught with once. She's a terrific singer. She sang some music with the quartet a while ago, and she's a good friend. We both graduated from Manus together. She doesn't know what's going on with me. She doesn't even know I moved out of my old apartment. I got to get back with her. Omar, my best friend in California, got to talk to him. And those people are all on the docket, and I will talk to them. I did. I went out for a drink with my good buddy last night. I always leave the phone on for the girlfriend because that's something that, you know, that's my one thing. That's my one little vice. I enjoy that. I enjoy having a steady connection. To her. And so I like answering those. I like getting them. I like getting those texts for now. But you know, how do we defend that time? I talked about protecting the time in another episode, but how do you defend it? Not just against others, but against yourself. You know, before I tell an anecdote about another person, why don't I tell you about something that I did that was disrespectful towards another artist's time? I sat there today and, I'm not going to go too much into my relationship, especially anything negative, but as a new policy. but the thing is that she just wanted to go and practice. She's a musician. She's a singer. She's trying to take some advanced guitar stuff through an online program, and she needs to practice. And so she really wanted to go and practice. And I kept on, like, you know, wrestling her down to the bed and pinning her down physically keeping her from leaving the apartment. At which point you should call the police. But no, I was like, oh, let's just snuggle a little more, you know, because it's a new relationship. It's a lot of fun. And there's certainly plenty to talk about, plenty to laugh about, stuff to argue about. I started an argument for no fucking reason. It's amazing how even I, who should have the most amount of respect for another artist that wants to get up early and practice, had virtually none. I understand where people come from when they just really want you around because they like you a lot and you can't be there for them. It's a hard feeling for both sides. And it's hard to justify doing something that no one is asking you to do, that actually a lot of people are encouraging you not to do, which is create this art that no one's asking for. And to justify doing that as opposed to being there for someone that you love and care about, or spending an afternoon with someone that you care about, or an evening if you're a night owl, you know, when you work at night, you got kids, you got a family or something, you got a night job, I don't know what it is, something that keeps you working at night, something's your internal clock. Regardless, how do you tell people that you can't do something? And I'm not just talking about friends or family or loved ones. I'm talking about jobs. You know, right now I had to protect my time. I had a parent who is really, really great about their kid playing guitar, but at the same time can be a little over assertive with the summer schedule, because they want me to come up to 120th Street and I don't live anywhere near there. And so I need to, anyway, it's a long story, but the point is I didn't have anything else going on there. So I was either going to go up there and teach one student and make these people who had been very supportive financially over the last 2 years and make them happy, which is important to me. It's important to me to make them happy, but it's an hour each way. Now I cannot justify a 3-hour commitment in the middle of the day, you know, for $75 or whatever it would be. I can't justify that. I'm not protecting my time. And it seems like, well, you know, Brett, what else are you doing? What else am I doing? Well, first of all, I'm doing this intro. And then after I get done with this intro, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to practice that solo piece a little bit more until it's good enough to where I feel like I can go up to an open mic and just in play it. And that's either going to happen in a week or a month. And it depends on these kinds of decisions. More than anything, it comes down to these decisions. What do you do with your time? Do you use it to make other people happy? Which, you know, you're going to have a lot of other people asking you to make them happy. A lot. I don't think most of us are lethargic. I don't think I have the impetus to go into the park, take my shirt off and get a tan right now. But that would almost be preferable to going and doing something that makes someone else happy. I know it seems very important, and it is. There is nothing more important than friends and family. That's true. Unless you're an artist, then you have a calling. And then you have a responsibility to your talent and to what you can give the world. And if that's, you have things that you can do that will affect more people. And more importantly, you have something that you can do that will make you happy. This happiness will spill onto the world. It will rise up from your body and it will spread to everybody else. Nobody wants to be around somebody that's unhappy. And if you show up to the party unhappy because you didn't get your shit done and you didn't have that spiritual experience that comes after playing a piece perfectly in the perfect concert, or really engaging an audience or stuff like that. That's when you are your most attractive. That's when you're most useful, and that's when you're most positive. And the energy that you give off and the opinions that you develop and the point of view that you have from that position is always going to trump the point of view of a miserable person that's there because they feel like that's the right thing to do. And the other thing to remember is that, you know, your bosses or all these other people, you know, when it comes down to it, they're going to respect you more and they're going to love you more because you're happy doing what you're doing. And not only that, they actually get to see the fruits of your labor when they come to your show or when they listen to your recording. Now, how do we do this? Carlos Rivera, I was talking to Carlos Rivera yesterday or the day before, wasting a bunch of time, you know, on the phone with him, I guess. But it wasn't a waste of time. Carlos Rivera, if you don't know who he is, he's probably my favorite guitar composer. I'm fortunate enough because of this show and because I played his piece on my first album, Whirler of the Dance, to have a relationship with him. By the way, he's got a new album coming out. We're going to talk about that on next week's episode next time. But we were just chatting. And we talked for about 2 hours about everything, about a lot of stuff. And he's also the professor at the University of Miami for composition, for film scoring. And he has a tremendous body of choral work. He wrote the Tombstones, the music for Into the Tombstones or Beyond the Tombstones or whatever, the last Liam Neeson movie. He's working on something now. He's a very exciting, dynamic, and engaged composer, and he gets a lot of work done. But he brought this up. He said about August, he said he has to do a bunch of stuff. Sorry about the noise. I know you guys can hear that. He said he has to do a bunch of stuff for the school from an administrative, you know, faculty standpoint. It's getting in the way of him with his creativity. And He brought this up in passing. He goes, "Yeah, I just don't have the time to do what I want to do, like, you know, to conceptualize or to write a piece or to pretend to be conceptualizing or writing a piece." It's that last part that gets me about what he said. To pretend to conceptualize or write a piece, to pretend to do that is just as important as doing it. Setting aside time so that you are by yourself in your mind. If you've got to think through some shit, if you've got to have a sexual fantasy, whatever it is you've got to do to clear your head so that you can think, you do that because the rest of the world is not doing that. And thus, they aren't even beginning to create. And a creator has to start from a place of calm thoughtfulness. And you have to create that environment for yourself. And you're not always going to be able to get up early and write a lot of music. You're not always going to be able to get up early and generate a lot of concerts. But the more control you have over your thoughts, and the more comfortable you are in the chaos of creativity, meaning that you're not always creating. Sometimes you're just like sitting around without showering, eating or reading or whatever. That's what we do. That time, that's what we do. Nobody sits there and writes music for 8 hours a day. If you did, you would die. Your brain would die. Don't feel bad. There are, you know, anomalies like Clarice Assad or, you know, certain people. Or I talked to the Brothers Balliet a while ago, and they said that they go to work. They go to bed playing the harpsichord, you know, playing Monteverdi with their wives. Great. How about the rest of us? How about the rest of us people that aren't, what about us? What do we do? I can't do that. I've got to be on and off and on and off. And in order to do that, that requires that I set aside a certain amount of time. Now, if someone wants to hire me for a dream job or something like that, please give me a call. You can reach me at, you know, just me. But the fact is, nobody's doing that for us. How do we defend our time when someone says something like, "What are you doing on Monday? And I say I'm working, and they kind of say, are you working or are you, what do you mean by working? And what they infer is, and I, this is, again, this is just like me, someone that has a lot of experience and a lot of with art and with artists and has a, you know, intimate relationship with the arts and understands the importance of practice. But at the same time, like me, doesn't always consider it a real obligation. And how do we justify doing something that doesn't make money, that doesn't, you know, protect our families, that doesn't, you know, necessarily even sound good? How do we don't even think it sounds good. It doesn't even sound good to us half the time, right? Half the time we do something, we're like, this sounds like shit. I just spent an entire week doing something that sounds like shit. How disheartening is that? How do you justify doing that as opposed to spending time with somebody that just broke up with their girlfriend? You know, or talking to your dear old grandma or something like that. You know, something along those lines. I don't have grandmas anymore. But what do you, how do you do it? You just fucking do it. You do it. You do it. You know that if the love that you have with that person is real, they're going to understand. They're going to feel bad about challenging you. They are going to be way more proud and way more happy to be your friend or your loved one or your mom or your dad if you are out there and you are producing things that they can be proud of and that they can share than they are if you're just sitting there pissed off because you didn't get to do what you're supposed to be doing. So do what you're supposed to do. And then, you know, it's almost like if you're in a relationship, you need to learn how to love yourself before you can, you know, love another person the way that they need to be loved. That's true. You know, all that stuff's true. Anyway, how about that, huh? It's all bullshit. I swear to God, I waste more time than anybody. I could watch videos on my phone all day. But that's my time. It's my time. I'm going to waste it my way. I'm going to waste my time my way, wasting my time. I'm not going to have you decide how I waste my time and then take it out on you or something. You know what I'm saying? It's my time. I'm going to waste it. You don't think the people in the cubicles are wasting time too? If I emailed my friends right now, any of them, who have office jobs, they would email me back immediately. Whereas if I email my girlfriend who's practicing, I might not hear something back from her for an hour. All right, so we have nothing to be ashamed of, people. We're all the same. We're all working the same. We're all doing the same stuff. If we are, just, you know, make sure you're producing. That's my spiel for that. What a long intro. I don't know. It needed to be said. It's on my mind. I want to, you know, pump people up for August. Let's do it. Let's kill it. All right. Let's take this time. We have this time. We have about a month before regular school sessions begin. After school guitar or whatever it is that you do. I mean, I'm talking to you. I'm talking to the people like me, the regional people. I want you to get your act together and do something creative and share it with me. All right. Email me. I want to hear what you're doing. We're all in this together. All right, so clean your muskets, strap your helmets on, and charge up that fucking hill. Here comes Arthur Campella.
Well,
I mean, your new music, you know.
Yes, no, I would say that anything linked to the music, let's say the music outcome, yes. The last time, one of the shows that I did there, for example, was a piece for 60 guitars. That was like even for all the people in the on yeah. the thing. So it was yeah. all the ensembles put together. Yeah, and I'm a composer. That's what I did. I did my PhD
yes,
at Columbia
do.
University. And
in composition?
In composition.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that. Okay, I thought you were a guitarist for
No,
sure.
No, no,
oh, okay,
no.
Cool.
My main, yeah. for example, right now.
I know about your body of work, but I don't think I got your education in my brain for
no, that's okay.
You Columbia, and that's where you teach.
I teach a Colombian as an adjunct, and now I'm doing a piece for my last project, for example. I composed when I was in Germany. In fact, I was a composer for the DAAD, which is one of the most prestigious entities of the German government.
What's it
called? DAAD. It's like Deutsch Academic, blah blah blah. Whatever is German.
Yeah.
But they recruit people from different disciplines like arts, music, and etc. So I was lucky enough so to be recruited, and they give you a huge apartment and you stay there, do whatever you want.
They do. Okay, so did you get one of the townhouses?
Yes, of course. I get a major treatment. Yeah. I was like,
as if kind of what they do for some people at Peter Sachs or someone at Columbia.
Yeah, that's what I got. I got. You know, in this program, there is all the entities of, the Germans cannot give it to Germans, but they, you name it. You have Ligeti, Cage, Carter, Hermeto Pascual, whatever, you name it. So big composers from all over the world. And they select this every year. So in one of those years, the 2012, I was lucky enough to be selected. And the best thing is that, you send your material, you don't know anybody. It's not that question, hey, hi, how are you? It's like, you don't know. I was rejected of a thing one time before. Normally, like everybody else that tried. But then I was accepted. So what I was saying now is that my main thing is in composition. So when I did this piece for Manis many years ago, even the New York Times, Alan Kosnan wrote a very beautiful review, a symphony for 60 guitars and stuff like that. And I made all the guitarists play, ping pong balls and and tuning forks and a bunch of stuff.
And that's a big part of what you do. You have the percussion. What is it called? Percussion study.
My percussion study. Do use this technique called the tapping technique.
Tapping, but you use actual objects like a spoon. I saw.
In fact, the tapping technique is something thought initially to give the hands a flexibility to not only attack and play notes, because, in the guitar, do one note. You put your finger, left finger there, and you pluck. And so to make one note, you use two hands. But I invented a lot of ways to do just, a note just with the left hand, just with the right hand. Right. And in the top of it, I incorporated, percussion stuff. But I didn't want this to be a gimmick. I didn't want this to people to, that is a very funny thing that has always occurred to me. Every time that you see, in the YouTube, those guys going blum, 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 tuk-a-duk-a-duk-a-dum, blum, blum, blum,
right,
they are a bad guitarist and a bad percussionist. That's exactly what I wanted to avoid. Because I wanted to create a braiding such that everything is very ergonomic. Ergonomic means that everything is very comfortable. Yeah. When you sit in a chair, there's no spikes for you to hit your butt. So the chair is thought about to be ergonomic to your body. So when you do my technique in the guitar, the gestures are all connected, and there is a very, very deep understanding of how noises and pitches can coexist together, and how fast can you do that.
Right.
Because if you do like tum tum tum, oh wait a second, I'm going to turn my guitar to do another pum pum pum, so you miss the music already.
Yeah.
So it must be everything like so glissandos take to your gesture, another gesture take to the next one, so when you do a percussion here, the left hand is free to attack a note. So there is always this machine gun communication between the two hands that braid the compositional notes, the flux, and becomes a kind of like a kind of a, almost almost if you're hearing a sculpture instead of seeing a picture, because those noises pop up to the front like so it differentiates themselves from the pitch. No, the pitch is pom pom pom.
Now that's what you're interested in.
Yes.
You're interested in the coexisting of different sonorities rather than one sonority in different notes.
Correct. Right. And with this, I did something that...
What are they called? What are they called one more time? I'm actually trying to get back on.
Percussion studies.
Percussion studies. And there's how many of them?
There are...
I've heard two.
Yeah, officially there are about seven done.
Right.
The number six I'm revising now, and then I have other ones already in storage for later on. But I have to interrupt because I do pieces for ensemble too, not for guitar ensemble, for real ensemble. Violin, viola, cello, bass, clarinet, contrabass. My next project, in fact, the one that I'm going to Brazil now to work, is a project based on a guy who constructs instruments, mm-hmm. and is done for his instruments. And he died already, but his name was Walter Smetak, yeah. and he lived. He was a Swiss man who lived in Bahia in Brazil. So the Ensemble Moderne, which is the most prominent ensemble in Germany.
The Ensemble Moderne.
Moderne, yes. Mm-hmm. He is. They asked me, together with the DAD, the entity that took me to Germany many years ago, to compose a piece that used the instruments of this guy, Walter Smetak, and used their instruments normally. So they're going to play their instrument, and they are going to play also the Smetak instruments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically that's
Smetak.
Smetak, S-M-E-T-A-K.
Hmm.
His first name is Walter, and he came to Brazil back in the 30s or 40s or something like that.
What part of Brazil are you from?
I'm from Rio.
You're from Rio?
Yeah.
You're from Rio.
Yes.
And that's a thing. It's a thing. You know, I had someone in here, you know, before. I've had, you know, a couple of Assads now in here. They use it all the time. They use the you too. So it's a tradition. It's a tradition to use that sort of mouth clicking.
Well, I would say that the way I use.
They just don't limit themselves to the sonority of the instrument it's traditionally presented.
Yeah, because Brazilians very percussive culture somehow,
mm-hmm.
and we come from different backgrounds. You see the very name Assad. You know, mm-hmm. is from. Arabic,
Iranian,
Iranian or Arabic or whatever. Right. So, you know, my family came from Europe, for example. So Brazil is a melting pot, pretty much similar, Rio, but Brazil is in total, like New York. You know, São Paulo has the biggest Japanese immigration outside Japan, Italians, the biggest.
Right. Now, wasn't there a Japanese person running for president in Brazil at some point, or running for like some large political office? There was some Japanese person running for like president of Venezuela or something at some point.
Oh, yeah, in South America there
right.
is.
Right, it happens
Fujimori,
a lot.
You know.
Fujimori did what? What did he do?
No, it was right. not in Brazil. It was like in
Paraguay or something.
No. Peru. Yeah.
Peru?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Right, okay, so that's what I'm thinking of.
Or Ecuador, yeah.
Yeah, and as far as...
But there's another guy that... in São Paulo, in the back days, there is other people who has like a Japanese descent and... You know, it's a common thing to have. You know, they are not Japanese; they are Brazilians, or they are Peruvians,
right.
or Equatorians, whatever they. You know,
right?
It's a you know.
They have a Japanese background.
Yes,
but that's
like
that's,
here.
Well, that's interesting. But yeah, I don't think a Japanese. We still, you know, they're not really in too many political offices. We don't
yes.
have there's not a lot of Asian American representation in the government in the United States, which is kind of a problem because there's lots of Asian Americans.
Yeah, but I think, you know...
like a lot, you
yeah.
know.
You know, it might be a trend of the white man, you know.
Yeah, white man.
In the government. Because you have a huge story of, you know, those guys, you know, only now there was a, you know, black president with Obama.
Mm-hmm.
You know, only now maybe you'll have a woman's
only
president.
Only now, right.
Only now.
This
so,
has been going on in
yeah,
Germany
you see,
for 10
Israel,
years.
Israel had right. Golda Meir, right. and, you know, Thatcher was in England,
mm-hmm.
and there is, you know, in the, even in the Iranian countries, in countries outside the United States, you have women, you know, coordinating,
right.
Running for president. There mm-hmm. is one that just won, I think in the Philippines. No, mm-hmm. Philippines, no. Somewhere, I'm not in the Asian countries,
yeah,
you know,
right.
whatever. So there are, you know, people, you know.
Right.
This is
a unique problem to America.
Yeah, well.
But as far as you know, you were talking about earlier something that, you know, when you incorporate these different techniques, and particularly the technique where you're using foreign objects to create, to slap the guitar, essentially. And we know what I've seen you do. When you do that, you said it kind of frees up your hand. Do you feel like that does it in like sort of a physiological way too? Like it makes it so that you can, when you do play arpeggios and scales again, do you feel a little bit more freed up? You change the neurological relationship that you have with the guitar.
No. When I do those called extended techniques.
Extended techniques.
Yes.
All right.
Which is like in techniques that extend.
Uh-huh.
You know, to understand the idea of extended technique, you could even go back to Chopin, for example.
Right.
When somebody's playing the piano, I'm going to go back to your question, but mm-hmm. somebody's playing the piano and crosses the hand, he is like doing something. He's making the left hand goes to a very high register. The left hand, you know, stays mostly on the low register in the piano. But just
cross, but he wants you to keep those little the trill going.
The trill going right. on. Then he crosses right. the hand, and when he does that, he's already doing an extended technique. He's extending the technique.
He's extending a technique that already exists.
Exists. So into what I do is like if you go to the classical guitar realm, you have that in order for me to do extended techniques, in order for me to...
No, you're fine. You're doing great. Yeah, you're actually maybe a little... You're doing great.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No,
I'm,
I don't
I'm
know
dealing
if
with
I,
myself.
So in order for you to do extended techniques, you have to have a very good knowledge of traditional technique.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you don't extend anything.
Right.
You know? But for me, in order for me to create these spaces between the hands, to create independence between the hands,
right.
I have to understand dependency.
Right,
which is like how to pluck one note, how to play and musics and compositions that imply the traditional technique, and so I have to subvert that technique. Mm-hmm. Only knowing it, so that extended techniques is almost a subversion of a traditional technique. Therefore, it implies that you know the normal technique. Otherwise, you don't do extended techniques. You just you could call theoretically extended technique somebody getting a guitar, any guy, and throwing in the floor. Boom! That's extended techniques for real. It is, but it's completely non-related to the technique of the instrument. So what I try to do is to relate my technique to a traditional technique of the instrument. That comes address your question.
Right, it is.
When I go from arpeggios to like a percussive sounds, I have to create a movement of the hand that is good to go back and forth between the arpeggio and the other.
Exactly.
So what is the most out there is the extended objection. I use a spoon, for example, to amplify the sounds that the guitar can give me, because if I scratch the spoon on the strings, this is something your finger cannot do. That's a step forward. For me to do that, I have to grab a spoon. This grabbing of the spoon takes time. So I have to be very smart to, for example, a trill in the left hand, blah, 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 while my right hand is like going somewhere else in a table, picking the spoon and
right.
So I have to create this kind of ballet in order not to interrupt the musical flux, because that's what I said, that's what I like to emphasize. To use the standard techniques is to also create a way for you to imagine the interaction between the hands. If you don't do that, if you don't create ergonomic solutions and bridges between one sound and the next, you're going to be doing nothing. You're going to be like, you're going to knock at the table, cluck, cluck, cluck. Now, wait a second. Let me go there and knock at the door. Tum, tum, tum. So all the space you have to cross to knock at the door. So this music of the knocking of the table to the music of knocking at the door has no relationship. They are far away apart. What I try to do is to make a music that is completely connected, noises and pitches and everything. For that, I need that gesture. You see, a ballerina, in order to do all these pirouettes and all stuff like that, she cannot stop, go backstage, change her shoes, and go back to do a certain period. She has to incorporate in the very gestures that she's doing. So that's more or less what I'm trying to do. And there is limitations, of course, you know.
But you push it to those limitations.
Yeah, there is limitations. I say, I speak in the following sense. You have a limited number of notes to play in the guitar. Now you don't have 300,000 million notes. You have just from the F to the B over there in the first string. Mm-hmm. Let's say, okay, that's a good limitation. So I like when there is limitations for you. And you have, for example, if I do a percussive sound, like boom, in the guitar, right? Mm-hmm. I can maybe do the sound in another place of the instrument. Those can be variations of that thing. However, my main objective is to create situations where this sound appears in a very privileged moment. Mm-hmm. I don't want to, make the sound gimmicky or repetitive. So when I said that joke about being you know, that everybody playing they are not braiding the music. They are playing a chord and then they're doing a percussion. They become a terrible percussionist and a good and a bad guitarist. So because they don't have time to be one or another. So what's interesting, if you put a Ken Woodenard, a very big, very great jazz player, behind you, he's going to be able to do much more things that you can do with So it's, that's what I say. However, even if you put a Ken Woodenard to play my music, he won't be able to do it, not because he's not a talented person, but he's not. No human beings can coordinate with a very fast pacing of rhythms that are appearing a very quick, like, how can he hold this stick and, oh, wait a second, is it, boom, here, oh, no, no, it's here, boom. Only my hands know when the noises come, because it's very complex, the idea of the interaction of these noises and pitches. So for me, this is a very important thing, because, and this creates what? Creates complexity. Not a bad complexity, that this is, oh, you want to complicate your life, why do you write this music that is so complex? No, the very energy of the guitar took me to this point. The very idea of the guitar, the very conception of my technique took me to there. Not didn't allow me to go gimmicky and say, no, push more, go more, see where you go. And then
what do you think when you say gimmicky? What do you mean by gimmicky? Like what?
Gimmick is like when you do,
when you just slap it for no reason.
Yeah. Yes. Gimmick is when there is no concept. No concept, no functional, right. No functional idea of why this is coming here. Yeah. Gimmick is like when you, for example, you get a violin and say, "Oh, we're gonna play it like a guitar," and you play bloom, 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 bloom. That's right. Not good. For example, I had this piece that's called Exoskeleton, which is one of the percussion studies,
right?
And is for not guitar, but is for a guitarist playing viola. Mm. Viola of orchestra. Those are viola that you play with the bow. But what's happened is that I had this viola laying around, and I started to play just for fun, putting in my lap as if it was a guitar. But if I just do like blum, 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 viola is very limited. So I say, what if I do the same things as I do in the guitar? So I notice that I have much less possibilities in the viola than they had in guitar, because I have only four strings, because their strings are very tight. And so I could play behind the bridge, I could play in front. So I started to discover ways to play the viola in this piece called Exoskeleton. The name is because I exported my technique to another context. So, but anyway, and instead of blowing bloom, 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 like a bad guitarist playing a bad viola.
Yeah, right.
I try to do something very technical. I create all these little sounds that is very complex. And complexity gave me a distinct way to hear a viola in a way I haven't heard before. Because a violist cannot play what I invented for a guitarist when he plays the viola.
Right. Yeah, right. He wouldn't be able to. He wouldn't because be able to do the arpeggios.
Nails, yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. So I do the fastest arpeggios in the West with the viola. You know, because viola does pizzicato. They can do plum, 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 pulling the string with the hand.
Yeah, but they only use one finger.
Correct. Boop, 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 boop. Correct. Yeah. But the guitarist can use the four, you know, thumb, index, medium, and ring, and create very interesting performance, playing. So also the idea of the pitch, you know, in the guitar you have the pitch, you know, F, F sharp, G, G sharp. But in the viola you don't have the pitch. How can I do? So I divided the viola in four regions, low, medium low, high, very high. So I say play around those areas. So like beep, boom, boop, beep, boop. So I'm not even attuned to the idea of perfect pitch in that. Just regions, play by regions.
Oh!
See?
So it doesn't even matter what string they're playing.
No, the strings, yes.
Okay, the strings, yes.
The strings deeply
But they get to choose.
The strings matter. Exactly, I want exactly the fourth string. In fact, I write tablatures and I put the hands position. Okay. So the guys see how the hands should be and say, play this in the mediums. Region.
Yeah.
He plays that in the medium. So if you play and if another guy play, for example, you're going to differ very little because you're going to be somewhere in the same region.
Right.
Your hands position are going to be the same.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth. So so you see, you go looking for different types of insights and ideas to bring the guitar technique to another realm, and you find all these things. And you put the guitar in a very privileged position in my way, in my view.
I think you do too. Yeah.
Because generally the guitar has a very lame repertoire. This is my view. They have very interesting pieces, but very lame repertoire, traditional repertoire. Mm-hmm. It doesn't compare to the piano or the violin or the French horn or whatever, you know, repertoire mm-hmm. of classical music. Because composer didn't know the guitar, didn't compose for that until very late. The 20th century has, you know, created in true the true masterpieces of for the instrument, you know. And many great composers didn't even compose for the guitar, like Stravinsky or Ligeti, or, you know, we are lucky that Boulez did Le Marteau sans Maître for mm-hmm. instruments and guitar. But, you know, the guitar started to get a... So what's happened, what I was just want to say in the past, that parentheses, is that people go to the past and make the guitar play a sonata or a piece by Chopin or a sonata by this and that because they translate. And what's happened is that although it sounds beautiful and sounds competent and nice, a guitar is capable of doing so, not with all the range of the piano, but what's happened is that it's not for the guitar. The guitar doesn't acquire its own individuality. Already with the pieces composed exclusively for the guitar in the 20th century, the guitar started to have its own voice because you can't translate that piece to the piano or to another realm without losing too much.
Right.
So harmonics and, you know, so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's very rare for people to transcribe a guitar piece.
Exactly.
Unless it's something slow, like, you know.
Yeah, but I would say, suppose, you know, it's when you have a very specific guitar piece that uses very specific techniques mm-hmm. from the guitar.
Yeah.
You can't, when you use very specific techniques, You cannot translate that for a piano because
no.
How can you do certain rasgueados or how can you do some, you know,
right.
You can't,
yeah.
You know. So that's the reason I think that with my technique, I managed to create a piece for the guitar, thinking the guitar as the ultimate instrument to play that and only the guitar.
Right, exactly. You know? That's a big part of your technique. But the other thing you know that is mentioned when, you know, you're being referenced is micrometric modulation.
Yeah, that's it.
And that's part of your percussion studies.
Yes.
So what is micrometric modulation?
Yeah, I don't want to bore your listeners with
well,
that.
Well, try not to.
Those are lectures like that. You know,
there's
the name,
big lectures. These
yeah,
are big ones.
Yeah, but, you know...
Theoretical ideas, focusing on theoretical ideas of micrometric modulation... But is that a part of we've been talking about your physical techniques for the first part
now
of
you're talking exactly
now we're talking about your compositional techniques
exactly my physical
your physical techniques are based on what is it like aside like it seems like what your the big idea of your physical techniques is that you're taking two conflicting technical ideas like hitting something with a spoon and using the left hand to play notes, something like that, taking two conflicting ideas and bringing them closer together until they have met the maximum amount that they can come.
Right.
Is that about
yes.
right?
But so, yeah, yes.
And then compositionally, I mean, obviously a big part of the composition is the techniques that you're employing.
Correct.
Right. But micrometric modulation, is that just too heavy?
No, it's not too heavy.
I've never heard of it. I don't know what
exactly,
it means.
It
what does it mean, like, not in a nutshell, but, you know, what's
the idea?
I
make it very simple for people.
Make it simple for me, because I don't know any. I'm very dumb.
For example, the questions are good. So here's the story. What is metric modulation? That means modulation, you know. I'm not going to go into the details for people. But mm-hmm. to modulate from one place to another, you're walking on the street.
We know that.
I could say that you can go from avenue
micrometric A, meaning just, I guess, smaller modulation. So
yeah,
you're not
smaller,
just modulating
from
E to D.
Yes.
You're modulating from E to E.
Exactly.
But it's going to be something in between.
Yeah, from E to E, from E pink to E red.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so is that the way you code it, is with colors?
No, I don't code it with colors, but I can make an analogy. No, but basically, it's this.
Okay.
When you play the instrument, any instrument, you are doing physical gestures.
Okay.
Okay, imagine a jazz drummer, right? Yeah. So here it is. Here I'm going to make for you a jazz drummer. Mm-hmm. So the jazz drummer goes like that. Well, he does. The thing that you have to think is that, well, how can he pass from this. What is the relationship between this roll that he just did and this little rhythm that he came up with after? It's because one thing must be a part of the other to be you pass. You could also pass to doom 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 or doom. You see, there are already put three rhythms completely different, but they are all related to this roll that I did. Because we are enveloped in physical laws. So when you do something with your hands, physical. So physicality is everything for me. I started to perceive that in metric modulation, the idea of metric modulation is like if you are doing something at a certain speed, mm-hmm. and you change the metronome, you continue to go on in that speed. So, for example, the same way you are walking in a small street, the same speed you are walking in a small street, mm-hmm. you are walking in a big avenue yeah. in the same speed. So, okay, in the small street, you're going to cross the small street. Let's say that you're walking like tung, 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 in much, much quicker because the avenue is much, much larger. Okay. So you're going to go tum, 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 tum. You're going to take more time to cross that avenue than to cross the small street. But you're walking on the same speed. That's my. So the micrometric modulation looks to find. For you have. Let's say that you have two rhythms. One rhythm is the small street. Mm-hmm. Another rhythm is the large street. So your question is, wow, what should I do? How can I pass from walking the small street to walk in the large street? So I say I'm going to maintain the same speed. And I know that I'm going to take more time in the bigger street to cross.
Right.
So, but the idea here is to create a bridge between. So your question really is, can I maintain the same rhythm that I'm walking the small street in the larger street? If your answer is yes, means that something in the large streets allows you to walk the same way you are walking in the smaller street.
Right.
Right? The same speed you are going.
Right, but generally we don't. Generally, we rush across the larger street.
Yeah, but I'm saying, but yeah. if I, so sometimes the micrometric modulation means that you are having complex, a very complex rhythm in here, and another complex rhythm here different from it, mm-hmm. you know, and then you say, oh my gosh, how can I pass from this complex rhythm to this much more complex rhythm here? So I have to find a common denominator. Can I walk a little faster here and then meet and match the common denominator of walking on the big street? So basically, in a nutshell, in a very non-idiomatic way, maybe I explain micrometric modulation is this: it's about ratios. You know, 3 in times of 4, 7 in times of 8.
Yeah.
So 7 in times of 5. So I have a triplet and I have a quintuplet. The question is, how do I pass from a triplet to a quintuplet? What is the common denominator between a triplet and a quintuplet? So if you create sub-ratios, other ratios inside of those ratios, then you manage. So I don't want to go into that because that's going to bore the hell or the shit out of the listeners.
But what you're saying is, so micrometric modulation is not, it's about rhythm?
Yes, totally.
It's not about tone?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. It's about okay. rhythm.
I was going with that, but the whole time I was like, okay, so when is the tone part coming? But about rhythm.
But you can transpose to the tone environment. But is another gymnastics.
Another mental gymnastics.
Yeah.
As far as this kind of stuff, I mean, you know, I hate asking people what their influences are, but I mean, obviously, compositionally, you know, you're talking about John Cage would be one with you, probably, right?
Yeah, of course, John Cage.
Gary Riley.
I'm more
John Cage.
Ligeti.
Ligeti. So you're talking about.
Yeah, Ligeti.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, well, his piano.
But, yeah.
Yeah, his piano. Were those sonatas?
The Ligeti.
Da-dee-dee-da-da-dee.
The Ligeti one? Yeah, those are like, those are older pieces for piano.
And was that, did it have like
Hungarian rock, it's called.
Hungarian rock is what it's called?
Yeah, but it has
But you're also not, you're a tonal guy.
Exactly,
you're
a lot
tonal
of,
guy.
Yes.
And when I was talking to Clarice Assad, she's, you know, obviously composer too, Brazilian composer too, she was talking about the issues that she faced in the, you know, American academic institutional environment when dealing with teachers, not all teachers. She studied with a tonal teacher, Michael Dougherty. But when you're talking about, did you ever run into any trouble being the fact that you were a tonal composer, especially, you know, at the time I imagine you were studying.
No, because I in fact, differently from...
When were you studying?
I studied...
In the 80s?
In the 80s, and then I studied here at Manhattan School of Music, and I studied here with Davidovsky, and I studied with Fred Lerdahl in Columbia University. I did my PhD over there.
What was your relationship with Beckett?
No.
No way.
Beckett is my piece, Happy Days for flute and and electronics. But my relationship with the people that I admire is another relationship. Those professors at Columbia or
Davidovsky
composition professor? Columbia University.
Columbia. Okay, good.
Yeah, at Manhattan School of Music, I study with other people.
Yes.
And the most important for me was Ursula Mamlock, that recently passed away. Was a very important
Ursula Mamlock.
Yeah, because she was from Germany. And then she, she lived in New York for 40 years.
You felt like that was your mentor, more so than like Davidovsky.
No, Davidovsky came after. All of them, I had mentors before, like Hans-Joachim Kohäuter in Brazil. He's a German guy who immigrated to Brazil and brought the 12-tone music. You know, when you're talking about clarice and tonality, you know, I remain tonal when I do works related to the popular music, that's entire life. Before I left Brazil, I did an album. I was a kind of a Frank Zappa of Brazil, you know.
Yeah.
So I did I have an 11-piece band who come on stage with me. I dressed half man, half woman. I sang like, and my rock was atonal. Very crazy. I did an album in Brazil. I had a following, but I was hitting my head against the cultural limitations of the place at that time, and I tried to sell myself in the good sense of the word to see if I could get a job in recording companies and stuff like that, or as an artist, etc. But that was difficult. So I applied for a scholarship, and I got a scholarship from the Brazilian government to come here to Manhattan School of Music, and that was like my time to come to New York. But in New York, I continue to do my bossa novas, which is like something that Clarice does, and I do some kind of atonal-ish tonal bossa novas. I do like bossa novas that have different types of rhythms, not only tum cha tum ta tum tum, but tum cha tum ta kum pa cha tum kum da boom. So 7/4 and 5/8, and bossa nova that goes through different bars. So I have a band here that plays with me. I used to have my band is very, very incredible American musicians: Denise Puricelli, Daniel Barrett in the cello, Denise in the keyboards, José Moura, who played the album with me in Brazil, came to New York and continues to play with me in many places. So I love to play, I love to play with my band. Yeah. It's something that liberates me. And from other side, I'm a very out there avant-garde composer doing noise and stuff. So that's more beyond atonal from one side, from this other side. So I think that these two sides of my production, they are very much linked. I feel that that slowly I am bridging them. You know, I still didn't micrometric modulate them into each other, but they exist as a pockets that I see myself very much. When I do I did the first atonal samba in Brazil. It's called Epic and Grace. Is the name of my album.
Epic and Grace
of a Disenchanted Race. Yeah, that's the name of my album when I left Brazil. Before I came to New York. And it was a very beautiful adventure because it's for me, I still consider, now that I'm an old professor, I would say, and not more the guy who did the album. In fact, the guy who did the album is dead. No, it's not me anymore.
Yeah.
It's another Arthur that I know. So I can say that is one of the most important, albums in the sense of of what was happening there in terms of every... aspect of it in terms of novelty, in terms of compositional output, mix of ideas, etc. But of course, with that album, instead of staying there and doing money and fame, I left there and it was my passport to go out, to leave this back in the 90s. So I did an album in the 80s, and I had an incredible amount of support from my family at that time, and my musicians at in Brazil, that you know, they were very dedicated to play that album, because very complex music, even popular pop, even for the popular music realm, is a complex music. I didn't write very simple stuff, and they all did a marvelous work. And still today, I play many of the pieces in the album. You know, this piece of that I told, that I come on stage half man, half woman, when I was and it was crazy, because it's a kind of a rock a la Bartok.
Which part of you was the woman?
Oh, whatever bottom? I put my hair to, because I have a
lot. Oh, so half and half going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Vertically.
Yeah, yeah. So I had my hair is long a little bit, but in the past was back here. So I pass here, the other one. So I have a clothes that I, half of men was like a, you know, a tuxedo, and half of men was like, I mean, was like a girl, you know. So they could, I turn around on stage. It was very theatrical, because I did theater for many years, not only music for theater, but I was an actor. So I liked this idea of cabaret, of the idea of like
Cabaret.
That's the reason that my music is so physical. Because I like the idea of intervention. I like the idea of the gesturality. Mm. And I think this is a part...
You also like conceptualism.
Of course. Yeah. You know, depending if conceptualism is
conceptualism not, seems to be something that actors in particular seem to...
Yeah.
Like when I have an actor friend, they generally like ideas in
Correct.
Music. A lot of them like Prince, for example.
Correct. Correct.
Who is all concept.
Correct.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So, yeah, go ahead, though.
Yeah, no,
it's... You're an actor.
No, I
Tell
yeah.
me about the acting.
The acting, I did many, many plays. I did adaptations. I did like Brecht, Bertolt Brecht. I did Nelson Rodrigues, which is a very important dramaturg in Brazil mm-hmm. at the time. He could create a lot of scandals.
Yeah.
And but I made the music for the plays too. So which gave me this dual situation. And and I used this very much when I do my chamber music work. Now, I like that musicians not only play their instrument, but if they have a voice, they could say something, or they could like make a noise, or they could, you know, they are there on stage to reenact being on stage.
Right.
You know. Yeah, they can reenact being on stage, because I like this idea of the malleability of musicianship.
Mm-hmm.
So you are not only playing an instrument, you are being played by your instrument.
Yeah.
You know, if you go out there and you put a guitar in front of your body, you're saying something already, right? You're not saying, hey, look at my guitar. You're saying, look at me playing this guitar.
What about the guitar? I mean, as far as, you know, being a composer, being a composer on the guitar, being a trained composer whose primary instrument is the guitar, do you play the piano?
Yes, I do.
Do you play it well?
I used to play
Bach. Is guitar your main instrument?
My main, yes.
Right.
But
What about the guitar? I mean, like, how did that get, I mean, have you been playing since you were little?
Kid, yes. I started, you know, my family.
Classical guitar.
No, I started with popular music.
Okay.
When I was a kid. But when I was about 10, I started to learn some tunes, like generally some easy Renaissance pieces, like, you know, Jane Pickwick book, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then I started to do Mudara and all this the pavans, like tang 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 tang,
right?
Tang tang. So I got a very good tasting. The same time, you know, and then I went to study with a very famous guy who was advised to me by one of the biggest influence in my life. I went to speak with him to ask with whom I should study, because this man was my father has a friend. And this friend say, oh, I know Sergio Abreu.
Okay.
Sergio Abreu is one of the biggest, more important guitarists ever, forever.
Mm-hmm.
The duo Abreu, for me, is the maximum of the guitar in the planet, ever, for me, Arthur.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I don't want to generalize, but it is. I'm sorry. I mean, I love the Assads, I love the Brazilian guitar duo, but the Abreus, they reach the God status. So Sergio Eduardo influenced me a lot. And my father said, oh, my friend so-and-so knows Sergio. Why don't we go to her home And then you talk with Sergio, see what he says. So I go in there, I play a little guitar, say, and he said, "Oh, the best guy," speak like that. "Oh, the best guy for you is Jodacil Damasceno. He's one of the most important guitar professors, not guitarists, professors mm-hmm. of guitar in Rio at that time and in Brazil. And he was the professor of a generation. Example, Marcelo Caiat. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard about him. He's like Marcelo won the, you know, many Villa Lobos competition. And he stopped because he became a banker. But he's like, see, if you put his name in the web, Marcelo Caiat, K-A-Y-A-T-H, you will see how amazing this guy is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a kind of Jorge Caballero type of guy, you know,
yeah.
at that level. And anyway, Marcel was there, I was there, and a multitude of other Brazilian guitarists was studying under Jodacil. So I was thrown in the midst of that. And Jodacil taught me a lot of and Leo Brouwer and Bach. And so my universe went exponentially up because I was obliged to really play. I play the suites of Bach. I play Villa Lobos, all the studies. I play all the, you know, I play, you know, Tárrega, of course, Carulli, Carcassi, Joe. All of this that I forgot. I don't know how to play one note. But they all, this exposure is what gave me the technique that I need to develop my own technique. Right. And my own technique has been very interesting because my pieces are being, the percussion studies are pieces that are being considered for tournaments or for guitar competitions.
Right, like a set piece.
Set piece. And people are winning competitions playing those pieces, you know. And it's a very unique achievement, I would say, in the sense that in the sense that it's an achievement that brings to the guitar such a specific technique that it makes it unique in and puts the guitar in a separate realm, mm-hmm. you know. So that's for me is very important.
And education wise, I mean, right now you are at Columbia University as an adjunct. I mean, are you teaching guitar there? I think right.
Guitar and I teach composition. Now, sometimes.
When you teach guitar, what's your approach with a student?
Well,
I mean, you teach children too sometimes, right?
Yeah, I did in the past. We
shared a student.
Yeah,
His name was Theo.
Theo, of course, of course.
So Theo was with me, and he moved on to you eventually.
Yes, yes.
Right.
Theo is wonderful. He is a very...
Is he still...
No. They moved.
They moved out of the city.
Yeah, yeah. The family moved.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Very sensitive, very good. He used to draw very well, remember?
Sensitive voice, yeah. Very, very good. I love that kid, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, he was in that phase that the family wants him to have the taste for guitar, or whatever instrument he likes.
Or whatever he does.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he's just...
Yeah. So, you know, I wasn't...
That kid's probably 20, 22 years old now.
No, in fact... Yeah, possible, exactly. He's a little older than my son, which is Julian, my son, which is 19.
Right.
And he's a little older, about 2 years, maybe 21.
Like literally, he was like one of my first students in the city ever. It's crazy.
You still teach around here?
Oh, I teach kids, I only teach kids,
Fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty good. I don't mind it.
But
I
mean, you teach privately or teach the...
Privately and in a school, Rodef Shalom in the Upper West Side,
Oh, great.
Yeah, I know I went to Manus.
I see.
But we'll definitely talk about it. But this is about all the time we have. Is there anything else that you want to talk? Are you sure?
There's nothing. I mean, the best thing that I can say is that for you to, if you have time and you have patience, to look for some of my music is in YouTube, in Vimeo.
Of course. Of course, people are definitely going to go look for you.
Yeah. So if
they can also go to, where I am, which is Campella.com. K-A-M-P-E-L-A.com. You want to go with the YouTubes and stuff like that too.
Yeah.
One of the questions I have for you is I noticed that your music isn't on Spotify.
Some of my string quartet that was
maybe
just...
I think so. But as far as what's your opinion about streaming music? Do you hold back on it? Do you hold back the rights sometimes to that?
Well, the problem is that it's some of the stuff... I don't have control of it.
Right.
Nobody does.
I know it's crazy. Right?
And then what I can hope for is to have some kind of collecting when you have your music played in certain places, you have like you know, rights collected from it. You know.
Oh, yeah, ASCAP and stuff.
ASCAP. Like
BMI.
Yes.
Is that BMI? Is that right?
No, ASCAP.
ASCAP.
ASCAP. Yeah.
Well, Arthur, first of all, it's great meeting you.
Thank you so
much. It was unbelievable.
I hope I didn't bore everybody talking so much.
I don't think you bored anybody. No. That was very interesting and very engaging. And it's good to meet a new friend.
Fun. My pleasure. It's like, thanks for being here, setting up everything for me. And I hope, you know, some of the people will enjoy. If you can, give the links. And and then if you can... you know, YouTube, just go Vimeo, put my name, go to Vimeo, YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
Vimeo, and then Vimeo, whatever.
I don't know what it is. Yeah, I get it. Vimeo.
Whatever. So, and then, you know, I just had the release of my string quartet in an album with Philip Glass.
Sounds great.
String quartet. And
that string quartet sounds good, yeah.
My string quartet is very...
It's very good.
Very out there. Be ready.
Be ready.
It's not my popular music, huh? It's my more advanced, you know... But I did
challenging music.
Challenging music. But it's very energetic.
So go check that out too, folks.
I would love to. Okay. Thank you so much for hearing me, and thanks to you, Brett.
Thanks so much, Arthur. All right, that's my time with Arthur Campello. This is percussion study number 3, part of it at least. And I hope you guys enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed it. And I'll see you guys next time. Have a great August.